Chapter 9. Out of the Cold and into Cyberspace. August 1991 was a month in which the world changed. Tanks moved into Red Square as the KGB and the old communist elite launched one last desperate and ill-fated attempt to prevent the demise of the Soviet Union. The coup lasted only a matter of days, and by the end of the month, the statue of the founder of the secret police was being torn down in Moscow, and the Cold War was truly over. The other event, much less newsworthy at the time, occurred in a quiet part of Switzerland, not far from Lake Geneva. There, at the laboratories belonging to CERN, which carried out advanced nuclear and particle research, the first ever website was put online thanks to the ideas of Tim Berners-Lee. A note at the top of the page explained to visitors that it was a wide-area hypermedia information retrieval initiative aiming to give universal access to a large universe of documents. Following the end of the Cold War, a new world order was promised in which the single remaining superpower would act as global cop to ensure peace. And out of that peace would come prosperity, driven by international trade, globalization, and technology, symbolized by the World Wide Web. Silicon Valley was growing in power and influence, increasingly decoupled from supporting the military, and instead focusing more on consumers and commerce in America, but also around the world. Spying and all that cloak-and-dagger stuff seemed a little passé. It was in these years that GCHQ and the NSA realized they could learn something from their old, now-departed sparring partner, the KGB. Cliff Stoll's Hanover case had shown that it might have been possible to gather intelligence over computer networks. Now, Western spies realized that others were connecting online, and they could find their targets on the Internet. And once they started looking, they found the doors were unlocked. "It was like Christmas," says one former senior intelligence official. "There were so many open ports, access points, and networks." This was an era in which nothing was encrypted and everything was easy to get to. So who were the first targets for Western computer espionage? At that time, there were only a limited number of users of networked computers in countries other than the US and the UK, but one very interesting community was online. The clue is in the fact that CERN put up the first website. That was the community of scientists. Now, CERN, with its particle physics work, would not have been of significant interest. So which scientists were? The answer was scientists working on nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs in states of concern. These scientists were communicating with their colleagues within their country at labs and universities and sharing details of their work. And of course, at this time, none of them would have had much idea about computer security and the possibility of espionage over computer networks. It was simply not something people in those countries would have been thinking of, which left them open to spying. One of Britain's first targets was the nuclear program of Pakistan, whose scientists needed computing power for modelling and research, as well as communications, leaving themselves vulnerable to GCHQ's spies. A similar shift to online spying came in the US around the same time. NSA in 92, 93, 94 started moving its activities onto the Internet, says the former U.S. cyber czar Richard Clark, and found that it was remarkably easier to collect diplomatic transmissions and other information when people used the Internet than if they were doing encrypted things over the air. One individual in the U.S., an Italian-American, was found to be particularly proficient at hacking and was hired to lead a team at the NSA, according to a former U.S. official. One Briton describes GCHQ's mindset as that of offering tailored Savile Row suits, while the American product was more like mass-produced off-the-peg Marks and Spencer's suits. The British thought that in cyber espionage, just as in human intelligence with MI6 and the CIA, they could offer quality rather than quantity of their product. German spies also seem to have begun carrying out computer espionage around this period, perhaps even a couple of years earlier, although not quite on the scale that some have claimed. In Russia, there was an awareness of vulnerability. That was evident to Roger Schell, who had been one of the first to understand computer security in the US Air Force in the 1960s, when he visited Russia just after the Cold War ended. He was working for a private company trying to sell software, and an admiral in the Kremlin in charge of evaluating security said their primary concern was what the translator described as undisclosed functionality. In other words, hidden vulnerabilities in hardware and software. Schell was peppered with questions at a conference about trapdoors and Trojan horses. The Russians had learnt to fear technology as a tool for sabotage. The farewell operation had also emphasized the way in which you could sow confusion and doubt in your opponent's mind and keep them off balance by making them unsure of what was genuine and what had been doctored, thereby forcing them to discard genuine material as well as fake. Of course, if you were an American spy after the farewell case, you would have two questions. Who else can we do this to? And if we are doing it to others, might someone else do it to us? This was the new world of computer espionage, one defined by opportunity and anxiety. When Saddam Hussein's Iraq invaded Kuwait in the hot summer of 1990, America gathered its forces to drive him out. Strangely, one of the people summoned for duty in that mission was Bob Morris of the National Computer Security Center at the NSA. He was sent to work with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. This was a highly unusual assignment for a scraggly bearded computer programmer. He was, it seems, involved in finding ways to target the Iraqi defense system, but the exact details remain classified. The first Gulf War is often portrayed as the first modern information war, a world of smart bombs and CNN, of deception and the lightning annihilation of a vast but static army. It certainly was a stunning display of firepower. America and its allies defeated what was the fourth largest army in the world in 100 hours. Burnt-out tanks, obliterated from the air, littered the road from Basra to Baghdad, which became known as the Highway of Death. Accounts from the time, though, contrast with the now-established view that the deployment of data was seamless. In fact, they make it clear that the use of computers was messy and improvised. Packet-switched computer networks were deployed but were not always compatible, meaning that floppy disks had to be carried back and forth, with people desperately trying to send data down slow lines. The use of what was called computer intrusion as part of the effort to destroy Iraqi radar and communications remains classified, but other techniques, such as clouds of anti-radiation missiles dispatched from aircraft, and even carbon fiber ribbons dropped on electric power stations to short-circuit them, seem to have been far more important. But taken as a whole, this electronic warfare was highly significant. The centralized Iraq system was largely knocked out, although just enough communications were left to ensure that a deception operation regarding coalition plans of attack could be played on the Iraqis, which could be monitored to ensure they had bought it, much in the way Bletchley Park had been used to check that the diversionary plan over D-Day had been bought. It may have helped that modified communications equipment had reportedly been sold to the Iraqis in the 1980s, which could be monitored. Even if computer attacks were limited, there were signs that the military was now beginning to understand the vital need to integrate information into warfare as part of the revolution in military affairs. Bandwidth and connectivity were going to be vital for warfare. Every change in communications technology had profound implications for warfare, and the point at which warfare overlaps with espionage. The telegraph had allowed mobilization and communication in a way previously unknown, leading to the cutting of cables in the First World War. Radio had allowed a central hub to direct Navy ships and others at sea. Now connected computers offered something new, but no one was quite sure what. U.S. thinkers and strategists began to talk openly about information warfare in the 1990s, even when it was not clear how computers might be employed. Because other countries were barely hooked up to the Internet, the big puzzle for military thinkers was how they would get access to enemy systems. In one publication, senior officials talked about limiting an enemy's mobility by targeting oil refineries. It says that this could be done through penetrating the automated control systems for the refineries in advance so that they could be turned off at a moment of our choosing. This was, the article noted, a classic example of strategic attack. On the 3rd of March, 1997, the Secretary of Defense officially gave the NSA the authority not just to spy, computer network exploitation, but also to develop what were called computer network attack techniques, meaning operations to disrupt, deny, degrade, or destroy information resident in computers and computer networks, or the computers and networks themselves. It was recognized that new weapons were needed. Alongside tanks, missiles, and guns, there would be viruses, worms, logic bombs, trapdoors, and Trojan horses. They are publicly available, very powerful, and if effectively executed, extremely destructive to any society's information infrastructure, wrote William Black, one of the NSA's leading figures, in a once-secret but now declassified internal article. The potential to attack another state over computer networks was already understood, for instance, by the digital coercion option of targeting the information infrastructure of an adversary. Such information infrastructures are expected to be primarily computer-controlled, operated by the commercial civilian sector, unprotected, and those primary infrastructures upon which military forces almost totally depend. For IW, information warfare purposes, access to these computer-controlled infrastructures can permit the degradation, disruption, or destruction of the network and/or the functions they serve. As a result, the computers become the intelligence targets of highest priority. It was recognized that shaping cyberspace is a long-term activity which will require a serious continuity of effort. America has a remarkably open national security culture, and after a while the U.S. realized that talking about this capability might not be such a clever idea. The Pentagon changed the terminology from information warfare to the less martial-sounding information operations. But word was out. Others were watching the American military closely and apprehensively, especially in China. We believe very strongly that the Chinese went to school on us in the first Gulf War, says Michael Hayden, who took over the NSA at the end of the 1990s after a career in the U.S. Air Force. We no longer launched waves of bombers that darkened the sun, but two or three bombers with two or three bombs that had an incredible ability to put those weapons precisely where you wanted them to be. So the Chinese became very aware that we were an information-independent and information-systems-dependent military. America's opponents considered their choices. They could not directly confront its strength on the battlefield. One option was to make the most of the asymmetric imbalance of power. This could be done in various ways. If you were a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda, perhaps the best option was to think low-tech, like hijacking a plane and flying it into a building. If you were another country who feared American power, though, then perhaps you could take a different path. Perhaps you could get hold of American technology to boost your own national strength, whether in the military or in the economy at large. Perhaps you could also try to exploit America's dependence on technology to try and find its weak spot, its technology, and then use it against it. During the first Gulf War, something happened that alarmed the Pentagon. A group of Dutch hackers had rooted around U.S. military systems, and so, at almost exactly the same moment that it realized its huge computing lead gave it the knowledge and power to spy on and attack others, America was becoming aware that precisely because it was the most wired nation on Earth, it was also the most vulnerable to being spied on and attacked by others over computer networks. This created a strange, schizophrenic mindset, which persists in talk of America the vulnerable in cyberspace, at the same time as it is arguably the most aggressive player, not just in developing but deploying espionage and attack techniques. It has been America's supremacy in cyber espionage that has made it so paranoid. It knows what can be done. What if other states could use cyberspace to coerce Americans and prevent the deployment of American power? Information warfare poses the greatest threat to the national security of the United States, warned one NSA official in the second half of the 1990s, just as the U.S. was gearing up its own massive capabilities. Computer networks seemed to offer small groups, perhaps even individuals, the chance to become empowered against big states. That was precisely what the hackers loved about it. The U.S. military also offered, in the jargon of present-day hackers, a large attack surface. In other words, there were a lot of places to get in. By the mid-1990s, the U.S. Department of Defense had a vast, sprawling network of over 2 million computers and 10,000 local networks, 100 long-distance networks, 200 command centers, and 16 central computer processing facilities. Another 2 million non-defense users did business with the department. The first cyber defense work was begun to do things like detect anomalies in computer behavior and monitor for intrusions. Computer forensics, trying to trace the origins of an attack for either law enforcement or intelligence purposes, was becoming a discipline, but one with huge problems. The military network was increasingly under attack from those seeking to steal its secrets. But how could you know who they were? Rome Laboratory is a long way from the Colosseum in Italy, instead sitting in a quiet town of that name in upstate New York. The Air Force Laboratory was home to the most advanced research on command and control, including sensitive projects like artificial intelligence and radar guidance. So when, on the 28th of March 1994, a systems administrator saw something amiss, they feared the worst. A person was logged on who was on holiday. A hacker was at work. They had then logged in and put something called a sniffer on the system. Sniffers were used to secretly monitor what information people were typing in to capture their passwords. The U.S. Air Force and Pentagon were called, and Jim Christie, who had worked with Stoll a few years back, got on the case with his team at Bolling Air Force Base in Washington, D.C. The U.S. Air Force computer investigative team in the mid-1990s included people who would go on to play a key role in American computer security, like Howard Schmidt, later White House cyber czar, and Kevin Mandia, who would form his own company called Mandiant. The team slept under their desks as they began looking into Rome Labs. They found the lab's computer system had been accessed 150 times by two people who had hidden their path over the previous 5 days, weaving their way over international phone switches in Bogota in South America before capturing the details of 100 users. Trojan horses were installed and the hackers took control of the lab's network, taking all 33 sub-networks offline for several days. Users' emails were deleted. They had downloaded sensitive, unclassified, air tasking order research data. By masquerading as a trusted user at Rome Labs, they also used their access as a jumping-off point to target defense contractors and other bases across the U.S. Government and commercial systems were so intertwined as to both be vulnerable to a single attack. The investigators got to work. They isolated the hackers onto one part of the network that could be watched, putting their own sniffers back on the attackers. They tried to trace the phone calls through which the attacks came, but Air Force officials discovered they were using a form of phone phreaking to route their attacks. They were like ghosts, intangible and elusive, running through a maze. The main hacker went by the name Datastream, but he was not alone. One of the most disturbing things was that the authorities could watch Datastream try to attack a site and fail. Then he would go into a private internet chat room that they could not monitor and communicate with another hacker calling himself Kuji for half an hour. After Datastream came out, he would then attack the same site he had tried before, but this time he would succeed. It looked like Kuji was mentoring the other hacker. They feared this mysterious character might be working for a foreign country interested in finding research data. Were they dealing with Russian spies, Chinese spies, Germans, or even American hackers paid off or being manipulated by a foreign intelligence agency? The Air Force investigators had got as far as they could technically, so Christie and his team turned to good old-fashioned detective work. They turned to Snouts, a network of informants who surfed the net. This was the equivalent in the cop show of the detective going to some dark street corner and asking the local hood if he could put his ears to the ground and find out who was behind the stick-up at the bank the other week. These informers were often people who had been investigated and arrested and had agreed to work for the detective secretly to mitigate their sentences. Could they find out who Datastream and Kuji were? It worked. On the 5th of April, a week after the attack had first been noticed, one of the informants said he had previously been in email conversation with someone called Datastream Cowboy. His location was a surprise. "He runs a bulletin board out of London. Here's his number," Christie recalls the informer saying. This was an important lesson of the Rome Labs case. The attribution problems of the Internet might be overcome with detective work and the employment of people rather than just machines. Scotland Yard's computer crime unit was only a few years old and was housed in Holborn Police Station in London. It had grown out of a team which dealt with company fraud. Comprising half a dozen officers, it was not well resourced and had to rely on equipment being donated by companies and universities. One of the team was Mark Morris, who had become interested in computers after putting case notes onto a system while based at the high-security Paddington Green station. The team he joined were trying to gauge the new problem, occasionally posing as hackers to go undercover and gather intelligence. They had already dealt with a few cases, notably one involving a man who had written a nasty piece of work called the AIDS virus. People downloaded a program off a disk that offered details of how likely it was that they would catch AIDS at a time when there was much fear but little understanding of the virus. Except there was another kind of virus hidden on a disk, a Trojan horse program which would encrypt people's own information so that they could not read it. They would then be told they had to pay $189 to an account in Panama to release the information again. It was an early form of what is known as ransomware, holding a computer to ransom. Scotland Yard investigated and found the author was a Harvard-trained biologist named Dr. Joseph Popp, who was arrested and extradited to Britain. He claimed he was trying to raise money for AIDS research, but was declared unfit for trial because he walked around with a cardboard box on his head. Rome Labs was now going to be the first major international case for the Scotland Yard unit. Morris went out to the US to talk to the Air Force team. The difference in resources was notable. "Compared to us, it was like Star Trek," he recalls. "They had so much more money and understanding of the threat." At one point, he was taken to the U.S. Air Force Base and onto a lift which went deep underground into a bunker reinforced against nuclear attack. As the lift doors opened, corridors stretched so far you could not see the end. It was, he thought, like a scene out of a James Bond film. "The Americans were apoplectic," Morris recalls of their attitude to the Rome Labs attackers. Their reaction was that these people need to be found and locked up for the rest of their lives. They remained convinced that a foreign intelligence agency might be behind this, a bit like the Cliff Stoll case. The British team traced back the phone calls to a house in the North London suburb of Colindale. They then asked British Telecom to start a pen register on the phone lines that recorded all the numbers dialed. They revealed someone phone-freaking. Scotland Yard could see that every time Rome Labs got hit, the occupier of the house was making free calls out of the UK into South America through Europe, Mexico and Hawaii, often ending up at Rome Labs, and then onwards to contractors in California and Texas. They held their breath as they saw him penetrate something called the Korean Atomic Research Institute. It was not clear whether it was North or South Korea at the time. The US and North Korea were at that moment negotiating over the North Korean nuclear program. If the North Koreans saw an attack coming via Rome Labs, they might well assume the US was behind it. Fortunately, it emerged the facility was South Korean. But what was going on? Scotland Yard went in on the 12th of May. That evening, Morris and other officers waited in four unmarked cars outside the Colindale house until Rome Labs confirmed that the attacker was in the system. BT also confirmed the phone line was in use through South America. One officer knocked on the door and pretended to be a courier. As it was opened, they surged in. The officers checked the house, but to their despair, initially found nothing. Then they realized that two houses had been knocked together and there was a door between them. They moved into the second building and made their way up to a bedroom in the attic. At the far end of the room, the police could see a teenager on his chair with his back to them, engrossed in his home computer. Like any other kid on his machine, he was oblivious to what was happening around him and had no idea anyone else was in the room. "He didn't hear us come right up behind him," says Morris. The boy was just logging out of the system. A policeman walked up quietly behind him, lifted his hands from the keyboard, and then pulled back his chair. It was only at that point that the 16-year-old grasped what was happening and collapsed in tears. "We scared the living daylights out of him," says Morris. The look on his face was one of horror. He just curled up in a little ball on the floor. This was the person one U.S. official report would hyperbolically describe as the number one threat to U.S. security. Like many a hacker, he had believed he was anonymous and secure. Richard Price, a talented music student, was armed with a basic desktop computer. He admitted to breaking into Rome Labs and other locations and taking documents. He said he looked for the word missile, only to find out about artificial intelligence. He explained that he had started as a phone freak. He had then begun to browse the hacker forums on the internet. He had first got into the American system at Rome Labs thanks to someone using an easy password that was the name of their pet ferret. A mystery remained. Who was Coogee? He had offered help and received files, but Price said he did not know who he was. For the next 2 years, the identity of the apparent mastermind remained unknown. The fear was that he could be a spy working for a hostile foreign power, Morris said at the time. Morris worked on the files seized from Price in his own time at the weekend. Finally, he found something that looked like a phone number. That led him to Coogee. So if Datastream Cowboy was a schoolboy, then was Coogee a master spy? No. He was Matthew Bevan from Cardiff, only just out of his teens. The police turned up at his workplace, the computer department of the Admiral Insurance Company. A manager asked him to come and look at the boss's computer. "There were seven people in the office, your typical men in black," Bevan later recalled. When police got to his house, they saw it was filled with posters and videos from the US TV series The X-Files, all about the hunt for aliens. The show's tagline was, "The truth is out there." Bevan had once seen some strange lights when going from Cardiff to Newport, and he believed the truth about UFOs was out there on computer systems. He admitted only to looking for a mysterious Hangar 18 at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, a less famous version of Area 51, where ufologists believed alien spacecraft wreckage was secretly kept. To Mark Morris's amusement, when he asked his U.S. Air Force colleagues what actually was in Hangar 18, they told him that if they did have any UFO material, that was where it would be, but other than that they could not say anything. Bevan had engaged in his clandestine pursuit because he could, the traditional hacker motive. "I did it for the pure adrenaline buzz of hacking a secret system," he said. Bevan told the police he started getting strange phone calls from people claiming to be interested in him. In one case, a caller knew not just his current phone number, but also a new one he had not even started using yet. They gave an Asian name and what seemed to be a Chinese phone number. He may not have been a super spy, but his skills might have attracted them. No evidence was found of any foreign intelligence agency involvement in the original case, but did someone want to piggyback off his skills once they were exposed? When Price and Bevan appeared at Bow Street Magistrate's Court, it was the first time Datastream Cowboy and Coogee had actually met. The U.S. estimated the cost of their investigation was $500,000. The supporters of the young Britons argued that they had not done any real damage and were just kids larking around. Price was fined £1,200 under the Computer Misuse Act after his lawyers said he had not been motivated by gain and had not done any direct damage. The charges against Bevan, conspiracy with unknown others, were dropped when it was decided it was no longer in the public interest. U.S. investigators were frustrated. Years of work had not led to much of a return. It was a strange end to what had seemed an international cyber-spying mystery. But there was also a wider point. If kids from Britain could get into Pentagon systems, then how secure were they? In February 1998, the U.S. was preparing for one of its periodic face-offs with Saddam Hussein over weapons of mass destruction. But just as thousands of troops were being deployed, the U.S. Air Force realized their systems were being hacked from a gateway in the Middle East. The investigation was codenamed Solar Sunrise because of the political context. Iraq was initially believed to be the culprit. President Clinton was informed. The attackers had only got into non-classified networks and seemed to be gathering rather than destroying data, but the kind of information that might flow through here would include the logistics behind troop deployments, among other things. The fear was that they could use the access to disrupt the support infrastructure needed to organize a military campaign somewhere like Iraq. "Are we under attack?" people asked. What constitutes an attack in cyberspace anyway? Does stealing information constitute one, or is that traditional espionage? What if, by gaining entry into the system, you understand how to switch things off and stop a military attack? Is that, in itself, an attack? A 1995 RAND study had asked what would happen if another state attacked and crippled U.S. critical networks as the country planned an intervention in the Middle East. The simulation forced the attackers to drastically reconsider their options, and the report contained a dire warning. The U.S. homeland may no longer provide a sanctuary from outside attack. Was this now happening? Senior officials briefed NATO allies to prepare themselves for their own attack. But then, as the cyber sleuths started tracing the origins of the hack, they came to a startling conclusion. The enemy was not the Iraqis, not even another government. It was 2 16-year-olds in Northern California who went by the online monikers of Stimpy and Machiavelli. When the FBI raided their houses, they found the typical hacker setup of a computer, Pepsi cans, and half-eaten cheeseburgers. An 18-year-old Israeli hacker was also involved. He had been the leader of the group and was the reason a Middle East gateway had shown up. We had only rudimentary capacities even to monitor our own systems at that stage, so the attacks looked more serious than they turned out to have been, says John Hamry, Deputy Secretary of Defense at the time. It was a false alarm, but only of sorts. The fact that a couple of American kids had been mentored by a foreigner to hack into American government systems suggested that it might be all too easy for someone clever to manipulate naive people at home. And maybe next time it would not be an Israeli out to show off, but someone with a darker purpose. It was the tragedy of a very traditional attack, a huge fertilizer bomb that destroyed the federal building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people, that finally made cybersecurity an issue at the highest level of the White House. In the wake of the attack, President Clinton established a commission to look at protecting critical national infrastructure. This meant major buildings as well as bridges, dams, and also areas like power, transport, and telecoms. The commission reported back 15 months later, in October 1997, with a startling conclusion. Rather than focus on physical attack, it spent most of its time talking about cyber threats. It found that critical infrastructure was increasingly being controlled by software and was vulnerable to attack. A satchel of dynamite and a truckload of fertilizer and diesel fuel are known terrorist tools. Today, the right command sent over a network to a power-generating station's control computer could be just as devastating as a backpack full of explosives, and the perpetrator would be more difficult to identify and apprehend, the report began, before calling for the government to formulate a clear policy to deal with this danger. That all sounded nice, said Richard Clark, the plain-speaking bureaucratic warrior who worked on counter-terrorism issues at the White House. It didn't seem to have anything to do with me until President Clinton said we need someone to worry about this, and since you worry about other forms of protection and other threats, you get to worry about this as well. And I had to start learning then what cyberspace was and how it worked. Clark knew little about the subject and was shocked by what he found. It was just as the commission was completing its report that the U.S. government ran its most significant exercise to date. Organized by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and codenamed Eligible Receiver, the 1997 test involved a two-pronged attack. First, power companies in selected cities were subject to a simulated cyber attack. The resulting power outages were made to appear random and unrelated, leading to confusion at the FBI as to which team to put on it. Senior defense officials realized they might not even know when a cyber attack was going on. The first 3 days of Eligible Receiver, nobody believed we were under cyber attack, John Hamry later recalled. But back then it was so novel and unpredictable that the game players just genuinely didn't know that that's what was going on. And the Red Force, the attacking force, did a very good job of masking their attack profile so that it didn't look like it was cyber warfare. This part was just a scenario and simulation, but still scary. We didn't really let them take down the power system in the country, said Hamry, but we made them prove they knew how to do it. The second prong of the attack involved setting the NSA's hackers loose on the Pentagon. They were not allowed to use any inside information but only hacker techniques off the internet and remained constrained by U.S. laws. The results were still devastating. By the second day of a 5-day exercise, we had to call it off because the team of internet hackers from NSA had gotten into the Pentagon and gotten into the command and control network. In fact, they had gotten onto the floor computers of the National Military Command Center, recalls Richard Clark, the very heart of the Pentagon. They could have sent secret-level orders to troops from the National Military Command Center. It was very shocking to me, and particularly shocking to the Pentagon. It was assessed that the attacks would have disrupted operations at select military bases, undermining the ability to deploy forces. At one point in the exercise, the Pentagon went to the National Security Council at the White House with a plan of how it wanted to respond. At this point, the Department of Justice explained that the actions proposed would be illegal since they involved operating through domestic computer networks. The admirals and generals were flabbergasted that some lawyer was telling them what they could not do to defend themselves. Suddenly, cyber was not just on the NSA's agenda, but that of the Pentagon as well. You can trace back to Eligible Receiver 97 the Pentagon's waking up on this issue and realizing not only that they had to do a lot to defend their own networks, but that here was an opportunity to do it to other people as well, says Clark. There is an alternative view of this exercise, though. Some of those whose job it was to defend against the attacks dispute the narrative. In fact, they say it was something of a fix. They say that their teams had spotted some of the reconnaissance for the intrusions in the exercise months earlier. They could see the vulnerabilities that were going to be exploited, but they had been told to ignore what they saw. One of them even renamed the whole thing Inarticulate Deceiver because he thought it was so dishonest. In his view, the whole exercise was a carefully crafted marketing ploy, artificially designed to ensure that offense won and defense failed, so that senior Pentagon officials could be convinced that there was a problem. You had to get a briefing saying the sky was falling in, says one of those involved now, although he does not dispute that it served a useful purpose. This was not the first time that those concerned about cybersecurity would be accused of exaggerating the threat for effect. In 1990, Britain's Ministry of Defence had only two people looking at computer vulnerabilities, mainly in terms of password controls and the like, but there was no real understanding of hacking. Britain had its first scenario planning for a potential cyber attack in 1995, partly as it had been pushed by the US to take the issue seriously, and American pressure over an ally's vulnerability rather than genuine domestic concern continued to be the main driver. In 1998, in the US, fears over computer security and espionage merging, which had been present since the 1960s, became real. Just as Solar Sunrise ended, another, far more sophisticated, intrusion was detected in defense computers. Someone with a poetic astrological bent was clearly behind the naming of investigations, since this one was codenamed Moonlight Maze. Most of the details remain classified to this day. It was on a totally different scale. It was described by an official report as low and slow, a stealthy, highly advanced and long-term campaign, only discovered by chance. Pentagon cyber watchers did not see anyone penetrate their system, but when they happened to check, they noticed that information was going out from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and other military labs, and not just a little, but a lot, and mainly technical defense information. Desperate attempts began to work out who had got in and how, but the teams struggled to grapple with the problem. One investigator watched a document whisked away from a print queue in front of his very eyes. They began to try to trick the attackers into revealing who they might be and what they were up to. Eventually, it emerged that someone had managed to install a back door called Loki, which provided access and which was so stealthy it might never have been seen and was almost impossible to conduct forensics on. In all, the attack had gone on for 3 years and was a persistent attempt to steal technical information from military and related scientific networks, largely by first penetrating academic and scientific supercomputer centers. One of the search routines the attackers kept using was for the word secret. These were no dial-up bedroom hackers doing a bit of freelance work for spies like Marcus Hess a decade earlier. It was very sophisticated. This was not two kids from Cloverdale, California, using an automated technique to bust into as many computers as they could after school, John Hamry recalled a few years later. They had strong operational doctrine on how they operated. These were people who not only had strong computer skills, but they also had very strong security skills. It suggested that it was potentially perpetrators who came more out of an intelligence background. The scale, sophistication, and duration of the attack suggested it was a state. The attackers were not using home computers. They might have used sophisticated techniques to mask their identity, but it was clear they were using powerful machines, the kind only a state was likely to employ. They took huge amounts of information, says Hamry, who believed it was an attempt to steal military-related intellectual property. The fear was that this might be more than espionage, like some reconnaissance finding weaknesses and shaping the battlefield ready for war. We were quite worried that an opponent of this skill could insinuate surreptitious code inside machines, says Hamry. In other words, that the opponent could leave something behind that could sabotage a system at the press of a button, the kind of logic bomb that people had been talking about for years. A new task force was inevitably established by the Pentagon, which looked at defense in depth, rather than just trying to hold off an attacker at the perimeter, which risked being a Maginot line that once breached was useless. The U.S. has never publicly confirmed who was responsible. However, insiders say they have no doubt it was Russia. The compilers that brought together the code to carry out the attack were in the Russian language. The attackers were operating from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Russian time and never worked on Russian holidays. Attacks could be traced back to high-speed mainframe computers in the Moscow area, allegedly one linked to the Russian Academy of Sciences. Low and slow is the way the Russians have always done their spying. And so, after a brief hiatus in the early 1990s, as the Cold War ended, Russian spies were back in business. The evidence seemed strong, and the U.S. made a complaint in 2000 and even sent over FBI teams, but it was met with firm Russian denials and minimal cooperation. A few years earlier, in the mid-1990s, there had been another sign that the Russians were becoming more aggressive in computer espionage. Many of the people working in the computer industry at that time used to attend a major exhibition called Comdex. Like most conferences, free gifts were often on offer at various stalls to get people interested. These were often T-shirts with a, perhaps, witty slogan or else a floppy disk with some new software you could download. U.S. Air Force investigators found that not all of these floppy disks were what they seemed, though. Some of them had malicious software hidden inside them. They would secretly install on a machine and then, if the computer connected to the Internet, which was not necessarily very often in those days, transmit data to another party. Who was responsible? The best guess was the Russians. A decade later, they would use the same trick with USB sticks to get inside US classified networks. The Cold War may have been over, but with the US and UK beginning to spy at the start of the 1990s and others reciprocating by the end, the era of cyber espionage had truly begun. And just as Moonlight Maze was unearthed, attention to where the problems of cyber espionage originated from was turning further east than Moscow. A new player had entered the game and was playing for different stakes.